You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us. My guest this week is an old friend to WICN, author and former Boston Globe reporter Larry Tye. His new book, The Jazzman, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. And although I'm not the jazz expert here at WICN, I do feel that this is as much history as it is music. So for the next half hour, we'll be talking with Larry about these three really trailblazers in American jazz. Larry, nice to have you with us.
Great to be back with you, Al.
Ellington, Armstrong, Basie, to this day, that those names resonate with you know, past generations, future generations. I'm sure we'll still be talking about these guys. But even the young musicians coming through today, in the jazz world, I'm talking about specifically, these three gentlemen really built jazz or gave jazz that platform, did they not?
They did indeed, and they gave a platform not just to jazz, but to all kinds of musical forms that came afterwards. If I could tell you a brief story about another musical great who was inspired by them, it was a guy that your listeners might recognize named Paul McCartney. And Paul McCartney of the Beatles was so in love with Louis Armstrong that he recently made a deal with the Louis Armstrong House and Museum in New York. The museum wanted his help raising money, and he said that if they would lend him Louis Armstrong's trumpet to just blow on for a weekend, he'd do whatever they wanted fundraising-wise. Well, he ended up helping them raise money, and he got to toot Louis Armstrong's horn for a weekend. And that kind of inspiration, where just having the horn of Louis Armstrong is the kind of thing Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie did across musical genres and across the world.
And you know that has real impact when an artist like McCartney, who there isn't a soul on the earth that doesn't know who Paul McCartney is, goes to that extreme, makes that effort to reach out. So obviously, each one of these individuals, has had a major impact not only here in this country but across the globe. One thing I wanted to touch upon that stuck out in my mind reading the book is the fact that we still deal with racism in this country. We still deal with issues, but we're making progress. I don't want to sound like we haven't moved forward. We have, but in an era where racism was still permeated quite a bit. It's amazing that these three African Americans got the name that they did, the recognition. So I've got to believe, and I want to get your sense on this, that in spite of what was happening in the 50s and the 60s in terms of race, these three gentlemen had extraordinary talent to the point where it didn't matter. Color didn't matter. Racial lines were blurred. It was all about the music. Does that sound accurate?
So that is absolutely right, and it was all about the music, and there are two aspects to the race story. One is the one that you just mentioned, which is the idea that they could not just reach the heights of the musical world, but stay there for a half century despite the racism. But the other half, and the part of the legacy that your listeners might be less familiar with, is that they didn't just accept and triumph over the racism, but they pushed back in a way that they helped topple the Jim Crow segregation barriers of their era. So they weren't just participants in this racist world, they were people who helped transform it.
And I've got to believe, Larry, that they're, that a big part of that was the fact that they had such tremendous talent that they could command an audience. In other words, people would listen because they had name recognition. They had already established themselves as credible, in this particular case, musicians, artists. So that certainly helped. I mean, if they were unknowns, completely unknowns, it might have been a whole lot different. But they didn't have to do that, right? I mean, they could have just rested on their laurels and said, hey, look, I'm Duke Ellington, I'm Count Basie, I'm headed for superstardom here. let everybody else worry about themselves. But they weren't selfish about that, were they?
They weren't. And what I think happened was that white men who would never have thought about letting a black cross their threshold in the privacy of their own homes were wooing their sweethearts with the music of the gravel-throated Louis Armstrong and the Duke Ellington Orchestra, and that white women who would have walked to the other side of the street if a black man were walking towards them, again in the privacy of their own living rooms, tapped their toes and kicked off their high heels to dance to the swinging music of the Count Basie Band. For once in America, race fell away as an issue as we all just listened.
Yeah, as I'm listening to you, I'm just picturing, you know, you may have a, you know, especially in that era, as you said, that, you know, that racist thought in your mind, but that dissipated as soon as the music came on, as soon as they heard the voices, because it really was all about the music. And I can't help but think that, you know, perhaps music is the key in many cases to breaking down racial barriers. And I don't, you know, I certainly don't want to make the book sound like it's all about a race issue. It's not. It's about three individuals with tremendous talent in this particular case in the jazz world, and the, you know, what they did while they were alive, and their, as you said, what's carried on for all these years. But let me go back to the beginnings again, though. Were these professionally trained musicians, or the three of them really just have to hard scrabble, learn on their own, just a love of the art form?
They all were of the latter. They were all hard scrabble, self-taught. Louis Armstrong grew up in a neighborhood in New Orleans that was so tough that it was known as the battlefield. And when he really learned how to perfect his blowing of a horn was when, at age 13, he was grabbed off the streets by a detective and sent to reform school.
Oh,
in the 18 months that he spent there, he learned how to play first the bugle, then the cornet, and ultimately the trumpet that he became known for worldwide. Likewise, Duke Ellington grew up in a neighborhood in Washington that, while it was much more middle class than Armstrong's, certainly didn't have a whole lot of money. And he learned that the way to escape that neighborhood and escape the world that he had come from was with his piano playing and his ability to bring people together in an orchestra. And Count Basie grew up in a suburb of New York called Red Bank, New Jersey, where he was looking, from the time he was old enough to remember, for a way to get out of town. And the way initially he thought would be the circus, and it ended up being the plunking the ivories of a piano so well that Fats Waller adopted him and taught him how to play in New York.
It's actually amazing. I mean, you know, people think, well, you know, you got, there must have been a gene, and, you know, whether there was or not, the fact of the matter is, nobody handed these gentlemen anything. They had to really work hard, and certainly the love of the music was an inspiration. But something, as I was thinking about, as I'm reading the book, I'm thinking again, we go back to that race issue. I mean, the music industry, especially back then, was dominated by you know, white males. Did they see these gentlemen as possible, you know, hey, this is a great investment, this guy's got talent, this Count Basie guy could be a, you know, this Armstrong guy, you know, these guys could make this record label famous, or did the record label owners, did the managers, did they see these three as raw talent and truly respect that talent and wanted to help them for that reason?
So it was both. Their managers, on the one hand, were hard-headed businessmen, and they were also tough guys, because this was an era, in the era of Prohibition, where jazz clubs were run by mafia kingpins, people like Dutch Schultz and Al Capone. And so you needed managers who were hard-headed realists and who realized there was a buck to be made here. But they also realized the buck could be made because these three musicians had raw talent. So were they enablers? Were they doing it out of the goodness of their heart or out of the love for green and for dollars? And the answer is absolutely both.
I got to ask you, we've had you here, we've had you on in the past. You've done some fantastic books. The last one was on the life and times of Joe McCarthy. Is it individuals, the lives of individuals that attracts you, or is it the historian within Larry Tye that motivates you? In this case, three musicians. Is it about individuals' lives, people who had to overcame tremendous obstacles, or just people who, got national recognition? In a case like McCarthy, he wasn't the most well-liked guy. What is it that motivates you when you pick a topic?
What motivates me is trying to use one person's life, and no matter how important that person was, Joe McCarthy, Bobby Kennedy, Ellington Armstrong Basie, the people who sit down and read a biography want to read about that person, but they also want that person to be a lens into something more universal. And in the case of Joe McCarthy, I used his life as a lens into America's long-standing love affair with bullies and demagogues, and the book was called Demagogue.
Right.
In the case of Bobby Kennedy, it was trying to use his life as a look at the way America changed from the conservative 1950s into the anything-goes 1960s. And with these three guys, it was a way of trying to use their lives as, in a sense, a biography of Jim Crow and of America's attitudes about race, longer-standing ones. So, yes, I was fascinated by all these individuals, but it's only worth writing about an individual if their story says something, speaks to readers and to America about bigger issues.
And I got to say, because I've had you on before, and I've read a number of the books, the detail, the effort that went into really bringing these people's lives, both in the public eye and in their private lives, and going back to Jasmine, the same thing. I mean, you had conducted numerous interviews with fellow bandmates, those who were still alive, people who knew them personally, I remember reading a biography on Chet Baker, and I thought, I never heard of Chet Baker really until I got affiliated with the station, and then I heard this sweet melodic trumpet player, but then you delve into his life, and you realize what a tumultuous life it was. It wasn't the glamorous life that's always portrayed. I remember seeing Louis Armstrong on the Ed Sullivan Show, and many of these people on television, even though it was back in the 60s in black and white. So what you saw was this. What I'm getting at is what you saw was this professional, famous persona. What were their private lives like, Larry? I mean, did they, at the end of a gig, when they came off the road, was alcohol, were drugs, were relationships difficult for these guys? I mean, did they have a hard life while they were making a name for themselves?
They had a very hard life on the road. All three of them were on the road for as many as 365 days a year. And while they traveled in luxury and with elegance in their later years, in the early years it was taking ramshackle buses and taking cars that often broke down. When they would find a place to stay, they often had to keep the lights on all night to keep the bed bugs and keep the roaches in their nests. And it was not an easy life. And Louis Armstrong dealt with that by every morning of his adult life, starting out a half an hour in the bathroom rolling a fat joint, and at night in his dressing room rolling another joint. And that was to relieve the stress that being on the road presented, but also being on the road and being black presented.
Yeah.
Louis Armstrong, when he would go as a headliner at the biggest nightclubs in Las Vegas, he would have to enter through the kitchen because the color of his skin was black. With Duke Ellington, he had a series of superstitions that he was anathema. The color green and the color brown were anathema to him because they suggested somehow the earth and burial and an end of life. And he had these wild superstitions. And the way he dealt with his anxieties and his superstitions was by having a mistress in every town he went to, and in New York having a series of them. The Count Basie was also, he had his own form of an addiction, and it was an addiction to the racetrack. And as soon as he would get into town, before he would rehearse his band, he'd put on his old yachting cap, he'd hail a cab, and he'd go to the nearest racetrack so he could bet on the ponies. And it would have been all right if he had won, but he lost often enough that his band at times would go without being paid for weeks at a time.
Oh, wow.
So each of them, on the one hand, were men of faith who said they read the Bible regularly and prayed before every meal, but they broke enough of the Ten Commandments that they became, in my mind, flesh and blood, real characters that we could relate to.
Yeah. I'm chuckling only because, you know, what the public today, you know, unless they've read the jazz men and got a real in-depth knowledge, and I'm not trying to belittle or downgrade. These were tremendous talents, and as I said at the outset, they laid the groundwork, if you will, in the genre of jazz. But as you said, at the end of the day, they were still human beings, and you know, at a time when racial issues were befallen many people of color, pay scales, I'm sure, were not equal to white performers. So there were a lot of obstacles, and you have to really think. 30, 40 years of dealing with this. I don't think I could deal with it for 3 or 4 hours, without just saying, oh, that's it, I'm out of here. So, you know, kudos to not only their raw talent, but also to their personalities and their belief in themselves. I mean, does that sound fair, that belief in themselves is really what carried them?
It is. Belief in themselves, belief in their side men and side women, knowledge that their succeeding was essential to not just feeding their families, but feeding entire orchestras. Can you imagine Duke Ellington, that when they went to Lynchburg, Virginia, the Ellington Band, to perform once, and his manager was trying to talk the owner of a whites-only hotel into letting Duke Ellington spend the night there. The owner of the hotel finally agreed, but he said, of course, there will be an extra charge for pillowcases and sheets.
Oh, God.
Because after a black man has slept there, we're going to have to burn them.
Oh, my God.
And this is the kind of indignity that these guys, they may have been the most popular musicians in America, but they also had to deal with the realities of what America was like in their era.
I'm listening to this, and I read about it in the book as well. But I'm saying to myself, how much worse could it get? No guarantees that, as you said, they were going to get paid. No guarantee that the next song was going to be a hit. It was really living from minute to minute, if you will. I just want to take a quick pause to remind folks that you're listening to The Public Eye right here on 90.5 WICN. And we are, this evening I have Larry Tye, who has written many, many a good book, and we've had Larry on a number of times. But his latest book really falls into the lap of WICN as a premier jazz station, The Jazzmen. Larry's written an in-depth, apart from the music, and I don't want to downplay the music, but Larry's really done a tremendous job of highlighting the personal and the professional lives of the likes of Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie. And in spite of all the challenges, Larry, to this day, I mean, you and I could travel into Boston, we can go to Berkeley, especially in the jazz section, and I bet you that those three names are synonymous with jazz. I mean, I hear that name. Whether you knew about them when they were young, but the minute they hear this, I almost think to this day that each one of these gentlemen, in their own way, is an inspiration for not only existing generations, for many generations to come. Is that fair?
That is fair, and it's sort of the same. When I wrote about Bobby Kennedy, I was surprised that half a century after Bobby Kennedy had died, that he still tapped a nerve in millions of Americans. These three guys do it in a very different way, but as profoundly, that if you were to play jazz on the radio. My guess is, despite all the great jazz bands there are today, the three most recognizable characters that you could ever have on are Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie, because their music spoke not just to their time. The way they lasted for a half century was by speaking to some universal values and somehow making us continue to want to tap our toes half a century later. They used to say with Count Basie, if you listen to his band playing and your toes weren't tapping, then you ought to go see a doctor the next day because something had to be anatomically wrong with you.
I got to say, as a music lover, that is so true. If you really love an artist and you love what they're doing, then it's almost a natural that, you know, that would it's going to hit a nerve. Right on with that one. We here at the station, and I'm not one of the jazz players, I'm not in the music, I do the talk show, but I got to tell you that our host to this day, I don't think there's a day or a week that goes by where there isn't a host either playing a Basie sound, a Duke Ellington song, a Louis Armstrong song, or that a request comes in. I mean, that's really saying something. Here we are in the year 2024. These three guys have been dead for decades now, right? And still, their popularity continues. I'm just amazed.
So this happens to be the 125th. This year is the 125th anniversary of Duke's birth.
Wow.
The 120th of Basie's, and next year we'll be celebrating the 100th of Louis Armstrong's release of what may have been the best set of jazz recordings ever, the so-called Hot Fives, and yet they seem alive and with us today. And it's because if you compose 6,000 songs the way Duke Ellington did, or you take trumpet to levels that nobody ever thought they could reach, or you have the kind of swing that Count Basie did, that will last forever.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, I'm thinking to myself, if someone tunes into the station, especially a younger listener, and say, wow, where is this guy Basie playing next? I want to see him live. Sorry. Yeah, a little late for that. But it is an amazing legacy that each one of the three of them carries over. Artists to this day, I mean, you're big on a Monday, and by Friday, that one hit wonder kind of thing comes and goes. It's just amazing. Now, with that said, does that say something about audiences then versus now? I mean, with social media and everything else, everything is like instantaneous and then move on to the next thing. Would they have been, no guarantees here, but I just want to get your insight. Would they have been as popular had they started today with their careers?
Well, that is, it's an appropriate question for a show on history as well as music, and it is absolutely true that these three guys' ability to last half a century was half because of their genius and half because we didn't have attention spans that were 15 seconds long. And I think that in an era of social media, Taylor Swift may be the rave today, but the idea that we will see her here 50 years from now is, to me at least, inconceivable. And maybe we'll be proven wrong, but I think there was something that people had more patience and had more loyalty to things that they thought were great then. And that's how it could happen, that 50-year careers could be born.
I'm sure listeners couldn't agree with you more. The pace of life was slower. But more importantly, and I've learned this over the years, I want to hear the words. I want to hear each and every phrase. I don't want the music to overpower, nor do I want the phrasing or the language to overpower the music. It was a beautiful balance, and there was a story behind each and every one of the songs and all the music that each one of them, put forward. We talked about their personal lives, and I'm sure that played into a lot of it as well. An era that I guess, for lack of a better term, has probably come and gone. But you're right. I think their legacy will live on forever, especially in the jazz genre. What the book is done now. It's out there. I'm sure it's going to gain momentum as time goes on. But for you personally, what was the thing that you took away from writing this book that really still resonates with you?
So I took away the idea that while I knew why I loved the music of Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie, that their lives off the bandstand to me were the other half of their legacy that I knew nothing about. And those lives were, just as we've been discussing, a life of partly triumph and partly the tragedy of growing up in an era of such overt racism in America. And it is the idea that every public figure has another side to their story, and especially when those public figures do as much to change the country for the better as Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie did. So what I would love your listeners to do is to contemplate the next time they're listening to Take the A-Train or It's a Wonderful World, any of the great songs that these three musicians did, to think about the lives and to think about what it must have meant for Louis Armstrong to be able to proclaim America as a wonderful world, given all that he was up against in terms of the racism. And you had to be the ultimate optimist to be able to do that, and these three were.
Well said. Well said. I couldn't say any better myself. It just really, you know, puts the final touch on everything, and you do walk away with that kind of feeling, especially if you love music and especially jazz music, because these three men certainly were and still are inspirational from beginning to end, and they've really laid the groundwork for so many artists that have come and those who are yet to come, as they say. Larry, real quickly before we close out. People, obviously the book, The Jazz Men, is out there, widely available, but if people want to maybe post questions to, because I should have said at the beginning, Larry's a New Englander. He lives right in the, you know, right here in Massachusetts. Always another good reason that we like to have folks like Larry on. But if they want to post questions to you directly, just get more information, how might they do that?
They can do that via my website, and that is simply Larry Tye, my name, LarryTye, as one word, .com. There's a contact form there. I'd love to hear from listeners.
Well, there's the invitation. The door is open, so we'll leave it up to the listeners from here on. Again, the book is The Jazz Men. How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie transformed America. My guest has been the author and a good friend of WICN's, Larry Tye. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you.